You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although the United States controls more ocean than any other country on Earth, the majority of the seafood we eat is imported. That's partly because iconic American local seafoods like Eastern oysters, Gulf shrimp, and Alaska salmon are exported to Asia, while much of the seafood we eat is farmed in Asia and South America and then imported to us. In his latest book, American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood, Paul Greenberg investigates why America's seafood deficit is so fishy and how the U.S. can improve its relationship with its oceans. It's published by the Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Paul Greenberg back to our show today. Hello.
Hey, Leonard. Great to be back on.
How much seafood do Americans consume each year?
Well, much less than land food. We eat about 15 pounds of fish and shellfish compared to over 100 pounds of red meat, and I think over 200 pounds of combined land food protein.
How does that compare to other countries' consumption?
We're about half. We should be a fishy country, but we are not a fishy country.
Because we have so much coastline.
We have so much ocean. In the 1970s, we made a huge grab to control more ocean, and we went out to 200 miles from shore. And so suddenly, we had 2.8 billion acres of ocean on our hands. Nevertheless, we still get most of our seafood from abroad.
Not just the coastline of continental United States, also, well, Alaska.
Yep.
And then Hawaii has a lot of coastline.
Yeah, well,
Puerto Rico.
The way that the world works with oceans is that basically you plunk down an island and draw a 200-mile radius around it, and you draw out a 200-mile radius, and then you make a circle, and that's your ocean.
Now, this is not true in other countries. If you go to Italy, for example, and you're near the coast, you're very likely to see a lot of fish on the diet.
You will see. In Italy and Sicily in particular, you will see a lot of fish, and fish consumption is higher. Spain is really a much greater example of that. But nevertheless, a lot of the Western world, whether they're fish eaters or not, are still importing a ton of seafood, mostly from Asia.
What percentage of our seafood is imported?
So it varies from year to year. In the book, I say 91%. I just checked back. They updated their figures to 86%, but still, it's huge. But keep in mind, while we're importing all that seafood, we're also exporting a third of what we catch.
Shrimp is the most popular kind of seafood in America?
Yep. We eat as much shrimp, nearly, as the next two most popular seafoods, canned tuna and salmon.
You write that shrimp tell the story of the unraveling of the American seafood economy. How has the economy unraveled?
Well, I like to call shrimp the Manchurian crustacean. It's the thing that
it is a candidate for that.
It is. Oh, I knew you'd come up with a good pun. The thing is that shrimp opened the door to the import of Asian farmed product. It was the thing that really started flooding in. And once that door was open, all this crazy stuff started coming in, anything from scallops to our own catfish brought to China, raised in China, and then sent back to us.
Why not local? Well, for a long time, San Francisco, the Bay Area, was the source of most shrimp.
Yep.
More recently, the Gulf of Mexico.
Yep.
The problem can't simply be the BP oil spill.
No, not at all. I mean, the oil spill is the sort of last chapter in a long chapter of decline. San Francisco Bay was rich in shrimp, but what killed it was the gold mining boom, the gold rush, because all of this arsenic and horrible silting and all these kinds of things messed up the San Joaquin Delta to the point where, there are still shrimp there, but nowhere near like there were shrimp in the 1800s.
But shrimp can grow anywhere, can't they?
You can. You can grow shrimp. You can grow shrimp in the equivalent of a bottle. There are these shrimp farms that they've started up in Illinois and Alabama that are actually containment farms. But that's expensive to do. And so in Asia, they found a very cheap way to make a lot of shrimp.
Is the shrimp we eat mostly farmed, not wild?
90% of our shrimp is imported, and half of that is farmed, and most of it is coming from Asia.
Countries around the world have begun domesticating their shrimp production by farming.
Yep.
Does the United States doing that as well?
Very, very little of it. We just are awash in foreign shrimp. And the reason we're awash is because we've allowed very poor practices to dominate the market. Like, I don't know if you were following this slavery in Thailand story about shrimp. I mean, it turns out that the fish meal that you grind up wild fish and you feed it to shrimp, it turns out that fish in the Thai industry, a certain portion of it is coming to us through slave labor. That, in fact, there are these boats out there that Shanghai crew impress them on board and make them catch fish for no money, and then that very cheap fish is ground up and fed to shrimp. So, you know, you've heard of blood diamonds before. I think it's time to think about blood shrimp.
How much of the problem in this country has to do with government programs? For example, the Swampland Acts were passed in 1849, allowing the government to drain swamplands to create more space to plant crops. Mm-hmm. Louisiana was spared for some reason, and that's why we do have some shrimp coming from there. But did that pretty much eliminate the opportunity to have shrimp in the rest of the country?
Well, so the Swamplands Act and the draining of America's salt marsh, and we've lost something like 70% of our salt marsh and a lot of wetlands as well.
And it hasn't just affected shrimp.
No, exactly. It's 70% of our seafood, it's a lot of 70s in there, but if you can keep it straight, 70% of our commercial seafood requires salt marsh to exist. And so, and in fact, what we've done is kind of driven us a dagger into our seafood heart by removing the places where seafood is born. You know, that's one part of the seafood deficit. But I think we could have a lot more seafood in this country if we took things like salt marshes and oyster reefs more seriously and really, you know, work to improve them and revive them.
My guest is Paul Greenberg. His latest book, American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. Isn't one of the problems with shrimp that they're pretty difficult to process due to their heavy exoskeleton?
Yes. Well, so shrimp, actually, before modern techniques came in, you know, mostly it was Cajuns who ripped them apart with their hands, and they had no problem with that kind of thing. But there was a young inventor named J.M. Lapierre who found one time, in the early 20th century, his boot rubbed against a shrimp, and the carapace came off, and the lights went off. And he said, oh, my God, if I could develop a system with rubber rollers. And at first, he actually tried it out in his mother's drying machine, an old-time washing machine where you dry it like that. If I could remove the shell automatically, I could make a lot of money. And he did. And he was 18 when he invented it and became a multimillionaire.
Most people know that with red meats, bone-in tastes better.
Yes.
Does that happen with shrimp as well? Getting rid of what are we calling it?
The shell, the exoskeleton.
Alter the taste?
You know, it alters it into the form that Americans seem to like. Americans like
bland
and tasteless things. You know, somebody once said to me in the seafood industry that shrimp are a dough delivery system. You know, you fry them and you don't really worry about what the middle tastes like.
And now, of course, we mentioned the BP, Deepwater Horizon oil spill.
Yep.
The rest of the world doesn't want to buy American shrimp. Should we even be eating it?
Oh, I actually think that it is fine to eat at this point. You know, the oil spill did disperse. There is pretty rigorous testing of the shrimp, and we're not showing contamination. So I think it is okay to eat.
A lot of the people who were working there came from Vietnam. They were Vietnamese
yes.
immigrants mm-hmm. because they had been doing shrimp farming in Vietnam before.
Yep, and shrimp catching.
Are shrimp native to Asia as well?
Well, shrimp are all over the world. I mean, they're 400 million years old, so they're older than our continents. So, you know, then there's something like two or 3,000 species of shrimp out there. What's interesting, though, about the Vietnam connection is that, you know, we ruined a lot of their coastal shrimp production territory by spraying their mangrove forests with the defoliant Agent Orange. Now we're messing up their shrimp producing grounds by importing so much Vietnamese shrimp that they're overharvesting mangrove forests and causing flooding and causing degradation of their agriculture.
You visited a shrimp farm in Vietnam known as Farm 184.
Yes, in that very, very intimate communist way of numbering things.
But this is a good farm, isn't it?
Yes, it was an organic farm. And what they are trying to do is to not use any antibiotics, to lower the shrimp density so that they are not like wedged in there. And it's actually, you know, a good product, but that is not, unfortunately, the way the majority of the farms work.
We're not eating our own seafood. Are the Vietnamese eating their own shrimp, or are they all sending it to the United States?
They are sending a lot of it, and I think I make the argument in the book that they're probably sending too much of it. I actually think they're riding their systems too hard, and it's one of the reasons that throughout Vietnam and Southeast Asia, a very bad disease, shrimp disease, called early mortality syndrome broke out, lost billions of dollars in the Asian shrimp crop. They're pushing the systems too hard to provide the export for us.
Oh, I just don't understand this whole process of catching a fish or having wild shrimp in the United States, sending it to Asia, having Asians send their shrimp and fish to the United States.
Yeah.
Transportation costs alone have to raise the prices, so it can't be a matter of price, can it?
It actually is. The most expensive thing about seafood is labor. And, you know, well, shrimp is not necessarily the best example for this. Let's look at salmon. Alaska salmon, a certain portion of the catch, is caught in the United States, frozen, whole, sent to China, defrosted, filleted and boned, refrozen and sent back to us. So what we're getting is double frozen processed in China. How's that for food miles? But the thing is that water, sea freight is actually not that expensive, but labor is. And the labor costs in China are orders of magnitude less. And then you have to ask yourself, though, do I really want to support that kind of cheap labor? Is that an ethical thing to do?
Doesn't wild salmon taste best if it hasn't been frozen?
Well, we'd all like to have fresh fish, wouldn't we? I mean, you're a big fish eater, I think, right?
I am.
Yes. So, yeah, fresh is great.
I try to buy it at the green market from the people who fish off of Montauk.
Yeah, the Blue Moon guys, right? Yeah, I mean, they're terrific. If you can get fresh fish in season, great. But it's actually more costly from an environmental point of view to get something through what's called the cool chain rather than the cold chain. To keep something cool, like cold enough not to rot, is more expensive and more environmentally costly than freezing something. And actually, with wild salmon, if it is frozen right at the processing plant, which it is in Alaska, and sent back, not sent to China and defrosted and refrozen, but sent directly to markets here, then it can be a very, very high quality if you defrost it carefully.
Getting back to shrimp for a moment,
yep.
How does Asia's shrimp farming industry affect the price of American wild shrimp? Is imported farm shrimp cheaper than American-raised wild shrimp?
It is much, much cheaper. And you know, if we had the fineness of palate to distinguish between the taste of a domestic wild shrimp and a foreign shrimp, foreign farm shrimp, then of course we could command a higher price here with our domestic product. But people don't. It's just shrimp to them, and so they just the Asian market really seriously depresses the price of Gulf shrimp considerably.
My guest is Paul Greenberg, author of the James Beard Award-winning bestseller, Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. His latest book is American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. It is published by the Penguin Press, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Paul Greenberg, whose latest book is American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. It is published by the Penguin Press. In a recent opinion article in the Sunday Times, you gave the example that when fish sticks are cut from blocks of imported whitefish in an American facility and exported to a foreign country, they are classified as American domestic production. At the end of the day, do the import and export percentages cancel each other out?
Well, we don't know. And that's part of the mess. You know, there's a huge problem in this country, which is called seafood fraud. And Oceana wrote a pretty good report on it. But anywhere from 20 to 70.
Well, excuse me. Let's get into what that is. That's when fish is mislabeled.
Yes.
A cheaper fish is labeled as a more expensive cut.
That's right. Well, so tilapia often can get swapped in for, say, American red snapper.
How can anybody mistake tilapia, which is one of the most bland-tasting fishes in the world, for anything?
Well, Leonard, you have a fine-scale palate. I remember this from the last conversation. You know, there are very few people like you who, in America, who appreciate the gradations of fish.
They see all fish as fish?
Well, I would say there's your white flaky fish, which, you know, I call these flesh archetypes, right? You know, there's white flaky, there's pink succulent, there's red steaky, and then something sort of gray and oily in between. And that's about it. You know, Americans don't get those gradations beyond that. And especially if you dump it in a lot of flour and fry it, you ain't going to be able to really distinguish one from the other. But, you know, so going back to the fraud issue, you know, anywhere from 20 to 70% of the seafood that we see in restaurants, according to Oceana, is mislabeled by species. And that's a real problem, because if you can't tell what you're eating, and if your restaurateur can't tell what he's buying, then how do you know that the management of wild fish is going according to plan? And I should note that one-third of the foreign wild fish that we import appears to be caught illegally outside of any management whatsoever.
Were things different when the Fulton Street Fish Market was in full force?
Well, you know, I live right near the Fulton Market, and I
love— Does it even exist anymore?
It is a shadow of— Well, so they've moved all the guys up to the Bronx. You know, as a, you know, when I asked one of the guys up there now, you know, where, why they moved him up there, he stuck his hand into his armpit. He said, "They moved us up here to get us out of the way." But the Fulton Market, where I live downtown, was an amazing place that used to actually welcome boats from the sea and get fish directly from our local waters.
So you knew it was always really fresh.
Well, you did know. I mean, it started to change in the 30s and 40s as we started getting more and more foreign product in and as we started polluting our own waterways. I mean, at one point, we dumped hundreds of millions of gallons of raw sewage into New York Harbor on a weekly basis. And, you know, you going to want to eat from that? Not really. You know, and it goes back to that sort of old Jewish parable, you know, you don't want to poop where you eat. And unfortunately, that's what most of America did from about, you know, the early 1900s until the Clean Water Act was passed.
You're right that the city wanted the Fulton Fish Market gone.
Mm-hmm.
Just a matter of real estate values?
It is a matter of real estate values. I've been involved in this fight to save the old Fulton markets through the New Amsterdam market. We've been holding these periodic markets in the parking lot of the old market. But basically, a company called the Howard Hughes Corporation would like to put up a 600-foot tower on the site of the old market. And basically,
the Howard Hughes?
No, they've licensed the name. They even have the signature, but they're actually from Texas. So, you know, it's one of these big fights that has been going on for a long time. Robert LaValva, the head of the market, has been fighting this unpaid, unsalaried fight for 7 years now. We're hoping with the new administration that maybe, you know, they could say, we want, like, have you ever been to the ferry terminal in San Francisco?
Yes.
You know, beautiful, great, a piece of old architecture that they turned into a fabulous green market and open market for all kinds of things. Shouldn't we have that in New York? Shouldn't an island city have a waterfront market, for crying out loud?
You say that things changed in the 30s and 40s. So where was the fish coming from in the Fulton Market? And where does it come from now in Bronx, where there isn't even a dock for ships to stop and drop off fish that they might have caught?
Well, so so the stuff that's coming in now is coming mostly via truck. You know, it comes via freighter and then it's offloaded, but it's not offloaded at the point of capture at all. This is one of the reasons that there has been so much commodification of the seafood system. Things like shrimp, things like tilapia that you can process quickly, freeze in blocks, that makes for much easier trading. At the Fulton Market, you still will see some wild American product. I mean, there is a lot of it still. But, you know, it's not there in front of us. You know, one of the things I note in the book is that seafood markets, individual fishmongers, went from controlling, you know, 3/4 about of the seafood trade to less than 20% in the last 25 years.
Now it's all in the supermarket?
And now it's all in the supermarket. And, you know, if that is the way we're getting our fish, no wonder.
Now, why did those stores close? They couldn't stay in business? We weren't buying enough fish from them?
I think it was convenience. I think it's sort of the general de-Europification that happened to New York over the course of the last century. You know, you go to Europe and you still have these moments where I'm going to go see the vegetable guy. I'm going to go see the meat guy. I'm going to see the fish guy. The fish guys were the last people holding on at the old Fulton Market, and then they finally drove them out. Fish people are very tenacious, and they didn't want to give up that territory, but they finally did. In fact, they had to sign a lease promising if they wanted to move to the Bronx, they had to sign a lease saying they would never, ever return to Fulton to sell fish ever again, or else.
You mentioned oysters earlier, and we've talked in the past on the show about how New York used to be probably the greatest place to get oysters
Absolutely.
In the world.
You like oysters, right?
I do.
Yeah. good.
But even if I didn't, I would love to think that oysters were out there filtering the New York Harbor. we don't have oysters at all here. You say that there are two kinds of oysters in New York City today. What are they and where are they from?
Well, so there's the kind that you can eat, which are not from here at all. They're from at least 30 or 40 miles away and sometimes from clear across the country. And there's the kind that you can't eat, which are actually in the water right in front of us. And these are the tattered remnants of an oyster kingdom that once had several trillion individual oysters in our waterways, filtering the water. And you noted filtration. The average oyster can filter 50 gallons per individual per day.
If they keep on filtering the water, will we come to a time when we can start eating the local oysters again?
It will be a long time before we can eat a New York City oyster.
Because of the rivers have become healthier for other fish, haven't they?
Yes, they have. And since the Clean Water Act was passed, the biggest thing is that now, it used to be when we had all this sewage and bacterial blooms and so forth, the oxygen levels in our waters were not high enough to support life. And in fact, it used to be that if your boat was covered in barnacles and you wanted to get rid of them, you would go into New York Harbor and the barnacles would die and scrape them off. But now that's not the case at all. Now we have, I just saw a 20-pound striped bass caught right off the battery. Those fish are more migratory, so they're not, as potentially threatening to eat if you did eat them. Oysters, meanwhile, you eat them raw. They do reflect the pathogen level that's in the water. And right now we don't have an acceptable sewage system and a wastewater treatment system to allow us to eat oysters from our local waters.
My guest is Paul Greenberg, whose latest book is American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. It is published by the Penguin Press. There was a time, you write, in the mid-1800s, that the average New Yorker spent more on oysters than on butcher meat.
Yep.
That's
yep.
because we had the local oysters, but aren't they very pricey?
Well, oysters are very pricey now, but at the time, in the 19th century, oysters were everywhere because everyone farmed them. They're very cheap to farm because what they eat is algae. There used to be something called the Canal Street Plan, where you would get all the oysters that you could eat for sixpence. And it was just the thing that we ate. And if you look at actually in per capita consumption, we used to eat as many oysters per capita as we now eat shrimp per capita. And what does that say about, dependence on local waters?
How much nutrition do either of them provide?
Well, oysters have great profile of all sorts of really good nutrients, like zinc, which is pretty hard to come by. When you eat a lot of oysters, you always have crazy dreams. I always attribute it to the zinc for some reason. But they're really, really nice profile of minerals. Mussels, which I'm sure you like as well, have really high omega-3s, actually. People are always looking, where are the omega-3s? They're actually really great in mussels. Shrimp, on the other hand, not so great.
And clams?
Clams are also have that nice mineral profile, but they're not as high in omega-3s as mussels are.
You went scuba diving in Jamaica Bay, the yep. last place in New York City that has supported the local oyster industry. Mm-hmm. What were you looking for?
Well, so I was with the New York Harbor School, and I don't know if you've ever had those guys on your show, but it's an amazing high school on Governor's Island.
And we have many years ago, yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah, but they have this project called the Billion Oyster Project, where they want to put a billion oysters into the harbor by 2035. But before we were going to restore oysters, we wanted to look and see if we could find any remaining wild oysters. So we went down into the murk. Visibility was about, 12 inches, and it went down to 6 inches. And we were kind of pulling ourselves along the bottom looking for wild oysters. We didn't find oysters, but we found clams. We found a lot of clams.
Which is good or bad, because you also found a lot of trash.
We found a lot of trash. The dive instructor gave me a knife, and she said, you should take this. And I was like, why? And she's like, well, it's a lot of line and other stuff down there. You maybe need to cut yourself out. But clams were there.
Were they edible?
Well, no, they're not. And that's sort of the depressing thing. I actually was talking to a guy who worked in Jamaica Bay, and his job was to remove clams from Jamaica Bay because they were afraid people would eat them. And he said actually when he dredged the bottom of Jamaica Bay looking for clams, he got so many used condoms in his dredge that they had to develop a special sort of inner condom filter to take out the condoms.
When we were polluting all of our waterways,
yep.
what were the people in the oyster industry saying?
Well, they were freaking out. I mean, first of all, at first, there are two kinds of pollution. The original pollution was just organic sewage, and people were getting sick from it. But up until about the 1880s, 1890s, people didn't connect sewage with disease, believe it or not. And it was only when it was established that sewage passed through the vector of oysters could result in cholera epidemics and all those kinds of things. But when other kinds of things started going into the water, heavy metals, all those kinds of things, you started to see some pushback, particularly on the West Coast. West Coast oystermen successfully fought the Rainier Pulp Company and won, and it was one of the early precursors to the Clean Water Act.
Well, the Clean Water Act was 1972 in New York. If you follow the law stipulation, that all American sewage must receive primary and secondary treatment before entering a waterway. Aren't we putting clean water into our waterway these days?
Well, we try to. You know, there are laws, and then there are regulation of those laws. And in New York, whenever it rains more than, I think, anywhere from a tenth to a quarter of an inch, there is this thing called combined sewage overflow. In other words, there's not enough volume in the sewage system to let the sewage go out through the sewage and the rainwater go out through another. And it's sort of like a toilet bowl overflowing, and it all mixes and it goes into the harbor untreated.
All of this sounds like we have a tug of war between something like sustaining our seafood and having industry. And the industry is doing the polluting. You write about Bristol Bay, Alaska, where which is home to the world's largest sockeye salmon fishery. It's also the site of the Pebble Mine exploration project. Mm-hmm. And is that going to kill off the salmon?
Well, so there is this tension in this country between forces that would like to do more extractive, dangerous things and those who would like to have sustainable seafood. But yes, in Bristol Bay, it's the home of the largest sockeye salmon run on Earth. And a group called the Pebble Partnership would like to site a 10 billion ton copper and gold mine in the headwaters of those salmon. And it's a very scary project, in my opinion.
Would it necessarily pollute the area? Couldn't the mining be done in a clean way?
Well, if you talk to the Pebble people, they will say, you know, this is going to be using latest technology, all this kind of thing. But the person who really convinced me, who's in the book, is a guy named Rick Halford, who was a Republican senator in Alaska. And he used to say that he never met a mine he didn't like. He approved every single mine. But this one, when he saw the sheer volume of it, if you take 10 billion tons out of anywhere, you're going to have a problem. And not to mention the fact that those 10 billion tons are highly sulfurous, and sulfur is not good for salmon.
You write that because we're a young country, we Americans carry within us almost a visceral sense of wild abundance used up and thrown away. Does the public even think in those terms?
I think we environmentalists do. You know, it's interesting. I was noting when I was doing research, I sort of was looking at around the year of 1972, when the Clean Water Act and all those other acts were put into law. You know what book was published in 1972? The Lorax. Dr. Seuss's The Lorax. And to me, that was like that was the book that launched me in wanting to be an environmental writer. And I think anyone who's read The Lorax understands these huge forces that are fighting against a natural and wild environment and understands that sense of loss.
At the end of your book, you call for an economically viable waterfront community. Does such a place already exist?
There are viable waterfront communities. I mean, every year we go to Martha's Vineyard, and to me that is like heaven on earth. If you go to the village of Menemsha, where Jaws was actually filmed, has a great three fish markets in one place, has working trawlers going in and out, and also has a tremendous shellfish community in the Menemsha Pond. So, yes, they do exist.
Well, we are trying to do things through regulation to save sharks who have been endangered, to save bluefin tuna. Mm-hmm. Are we succeeding?
Well, this country has really revamped its fishing regulations in the last 20, 30 years. Ever since the 1996 Sustainable Fisheries Act was added on to the Magnuson-Stevens Act, we've mandated that we have to define overfishing and we have to stop it. And actually, we're really getting there. And something like three dozen fish stocks have been rebuilt in the last 20 years.
Unfortunately, when we do have nice bluefin tuna, it all gets bought by Japanese fish companies.
Sure.
And shipped to Japan.
Yeah, it does. You know, and again, this is an example of the low grading of the American seafood system. all the really, you know, there was a fisherman that I interviewed recently in California, and I asked him why this was happening. He goes, man, American public are not hip to fish. And it's true. We're just not hip to fish. So, you know, we were talking during the break about black cod, you know, which is a lovely, lovely fish. And, you know, you find it in odd restaurants, but most of the black cod in this country is getting shipped abroad. By the way, did you know that black cod is also sable? Like, remember as a kid having smoked sable on a bagel? That's black cod.
And it's abundant near New York?
Black cod, as you know, is a West Coast fish, mostly caught off California, Oregon, Washington, and Alaska.
Paul Greenberg's latest book is called American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. It is published by the Penguin Press. And, Paul, it's always a pleasure having you on our show, even though you come by with some scary news.
You know, the thing is, we shouldn't forget that the oceans and our oceans are really, really rich in life. And we can eat from them with confidence that we're doing a better and better job.